feeling his insignificance, as some people did when contemplating the infinite number of stars in the heavens. The defining moment of college came when Gavin was having sex with a beautiful freshman named Diana Prell in the broom closet of an Irish pub. He couldn't remember how they had ended up in the broom closet, but he remembered that it had been Diana's idea, that she had led him in there. When the sex was over, however, she accused him of having forced himself on her. She did not go so far as to press charges, but the term date rape was silently attached to his name. He pretty much lost the few friends he had, but he kept going to parties anyway and took up smoking so that he would have something to do, a group of people to bond with, if only for bumming a cigarette or a light. His resentment and alienation grew. He felt something underneath his surface starting to rot. After college, Gavin Sr. set up a job for Gavin at Cap and Lehigh, an accounting firm in Chicago, and it was there that his life of white-collar crime began. He succumbed to what he now saw was classic peer pressure when he was approached by a group of second-year hires who had an embezzlement ring going. He could have blown the whistle, or he could have turned a blind eye, but he so desperately wanted acceptance by this group that he performed the most dangerous of the jobs, moving funds from one account to another and changing the amounts in the switch, then placing the difference in a slush fund that everyone in on the scam split. They got caught after only a few months, not because of Gavin, but because of another fellow who fingered everyone in the ring. Because they were all recent hires, very young, and incredibly stupid, and because the amount embezzled was less than $10,000, Cap and Lehigh fired them, but did not, mercifully, press charges. Still, Gavin was left in a state of disgrace, and he was unhirable. His parents were at wit's end. Gavin lived at home that winter, jobless, listening to mournful jazz, and spending his parents' money on finely tailored clothes that, as far as he could tell, he would never again have a reason to wear. In the summer, he trailed his parents to Nantucket, and in the fall, they suggested he stay and try to make his own way. Either Gavin's parents thought the sea air and cold gray winter would be fortifying for his character, or they simply wanted him banished, tucked away on an island where they didn't have to deal with him in the day-to-day. Gavin was allowed to live in the house overlooking Cisco Beach for free, but he had to find a job and pay for the utilities. Nantucket was a small place, and this suited Gavin, but he had a hard time finding a way to distinguish himself. He babysat paintings in an art gallery for a few months, but found it too boring. He waited tables at the Brotherhood, but found it too messy and hot. Then he found Nantucket's children, and something clicked. This was odd, his parents thought, because he disliked children. His skill set, as it turned out, was exactly that of a fastidious administrator. He was prompt, he was neat, he was impeccably polite, and he never forgot a thing. He built himself a persona. The tiny red ladybug of a car, his penchant for classical music and foreign films, and Italian shirts from the haberdashery. But lately, he had begun to feel hemmed in by his own identity. He wanted friends instead of acquaintances. He wanted to be invited out to see a band and drink beer at the Chicken Box. He wanted to be talked to instead of wondered about. His closest friends now were Rosemary Pinkle, a recently widowed woman he knew from the Episcopal Church, and Locke's wife, Daphne Dixon, who liked to gossip as much as he did. He was stealing, not because he needed the money, though the utility bills for a 6,000-square-foot house weren't cheap, and his raises at work never garnered him as much butter as he hoped, but because he wanted a change. He would stockpile the cash and save it for his escape. When the time was right, he would flee the country. For Thailand, or Vietnam, or Laos, where he would find a beautiful girl and live freely, without judgment. Here was one thing that surprised Gavin about the stealing. It enhanced the quality of his day-to-day life. He went from floating mindlessly through the 1001 tasks of his day to sitting on the edge of his seat, noticing everything, taking nothing for granted. He was aware of the $500 bills in his pocket. He was aware of the crumpled deposit slip buried in the trash can. He could feel the pressure of his fingertips against the computer keyboard as he typed in the deposit amount. He could feel the sharp zing of the air against his clean-shaven cheek. He could hear Locke, across the room, drawing and expelling breath. He could pick apart each individual note of the Chopin Polonaise that was played on the Bose radio. Which note would be playing at the moment he was discovered? It gave him a chill to wonder. The phone rang, and Gavin nearly jumped out of his rolling office chair. Locke looked up.
Too much caffeine at lunch?
Double latte, Gavin confirmed.
If it's Daphne, tell her I'm out, Locke said.
Gavin nodded. This was a standard request. Although Gavin regarded Daphne as a comrade in the quest to keep life interesting, he did not tell her that her husband routinely refused her calls.
Nantucket's children.
Gavin? Gavin licked his teeth and stared straight ahead at the freestanding coat rack, like a prop straight out of Dragnet. Draped with Locke's Burberry overcoat and Gavin's nicer cashmere jacket from Hickey Freeman. It was Claire Crispin. Again.
Hello, Claire.
Hi. Is Locke handy?
Handy. She always said this. Maybe because her husband was a carpenter, and the phrase drove Gavin apeshit.
Was Locke handy? No, he wasn't handy. He couldn't even change the toilet paper roll in the bathroom. Gavin had used that joke once, then wearied of it. He had wearied of Claire in general, and yet she was always around, calling Locke, popping in. She would stop by at 8:15 on her way back from dropping the kids off at school, looking like death on a stick, in her stretched-out, shapeless yoga clothes, wearing no makeup, her hair in a haphazard bun. Gavin would never be seen looking that way in public. He didn't like to look that way in private. Claire always had something to pick up or drop off or something she wanted Gavin to pull from the files, or she wanted Locke's ear on a conflict she had had via email with Isabel French. It was so tiresome. Gavin didn't pay close attention. More often than not, Claire would call later that day, and when Gavin answered the phone, she would say,
"Hi, it's Claire. Did you miss me?"
And Gavin would think, "How can I miss you when you won't go away?" He usually tried to muster a little chuckle, and then Claire would say, wearing his patience down to a frayed thread,
"Is Locke handy?"
"Now," Gavin said.
"Please hold."
He pushed the button on the phone and said to Locke,
"It's Claire."
"Okay," Locke said. "Great, put her through."
Locke did not take Daphne's calls, but he always took Claire's.
What did that say?
Gavin watched Locke closely. His eyes did seem to brighten when he said hello, and his voice seemed to take on a tender tone, and then Locke swiveled in his chair and faced the 20-paned window, which put his back to Gavin. It was a gesture Gavin knew well, in many incarnations. Gavin kept his hands in his jacket pockets when he went to the bank with a deposit, and he did all of the banking computer work with the screen tilted away from Locke's desk, most often when Locke was at lunch. These were the ways of a person with a secret. Turn your back. Speak in short, innocuous phrases that give nothing away, as Locke was now doing.
"Yes, I see what you mean. Okay. Not right now."
"You bet."
"Yep, me too."
Gavin narrowed his eyes at Locke's turned back.
Affair?
It just wasn't possible. Claire came in all the time looking like she had just spent 6 weeks in Outward Bound, but hadn't had time for her back-to-civilization shower. This was not the way a woman presented herself to a lover. Gavin had bedded 14 women in his lifetime, none of them special.
but all of them clean. Besides, Claire wasn't Locke's type, and it wasn't only the fact that she looked like she got dressed in a dark closet. She was too casual a person for Locke. She was too comfortable and chummy. She wasn't refined. If Gavin had suggested to Daphne that Locke was having an affair with Claire Crispin, Daphne would have laughed wickedly and unleashed an invective about Claire that would have made even Gavin uncomfortable, and unwashed would have been the nicest of it. Daphne worried about Locke and Isabel French, and she was correct to worry, because Isabel French was classically beautiful and polished, and newly single. Gavin was interested in Isabel himself, though she was way, 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 way out of his league. But Isabel hadn't been to the island in months, and she rarely called. When she did call, Locke sometimes asked Gavin to take a message. Otherwise, the conversations were terse, with Locke conveying unmistakable impatience. "No," Gavin told Daphne with full confidence. "Nothing is going on between Locke and Isabel French." But now there was this vibe, this near certainty that Locke, like Gavin, had a secret. Look at him, tapping his foot against the ancient radiator. That was a nervous tic. Gavin recognized it because he monitored himself for nervous tics all the time. The humming, the knuckle cracking, the licking of the teeth, the compulsive checking of his pants pocket. Was the cash still there, all of it? It took a criminal to recognize a criminal, and Gavin recognized a criminal. "Okay," Locke said to Claire. "I'll follow up. Yep. See you." He hung up. "How is Claire?" Gavin said. He asked as nonchalantly as possible. Maybe he was just projecting. Doing a bad thing came so easily for him that he assumed it would come easily for others. Locke smiled. Fondly? Guiltily? Gavin couldn't tell. "Oh," he said. "She's fine." Carter won $1,900 on March Madness, which was, he informed Siobhan, a basketball tournament, and a very big deal in America. Siobhan was beside herself about the gambling, even at the win, even after Carter pulled five bills off his wad of hundreds and said, "Go shopping." Siobhan did exactly that, despite the fact that she should have put the money right into the bank to hedge against future losses, despite the fact that she should have thrown the money in Carter's face and told him point blank that he had a problem. The month of March had been dismal for Siobhan. There was no work, only an endless string of hours spent with the kids at the ice rink eating cardboard pizza and stale popcorn and drinking flat diet soda. Claire had been strange and distant, working all the time in the hot shop on the project for the summer gala, attending her meetings at night. Twice now, when Siobhan had called to see if Claire wanted to go to 56 Union for a glass of Cabernet and a pile of crispy hot frites, Claire had turned her down, saying she had a meeting. Siobhan said, "Who goes to these meetings? Everyone or just you and Locke?" There was a pause. Then Claire said, "There's a committee." Her tone of voice contained the accusation that while technically Siobhan was on the committee, she had yet to attend a single meeting, and wouldn't attend either, Siobhan thought haughtily, until they were offered the catering job. The fact of the matter was, things between Claire and Siobhan had not been right since the day Siobhan caught Claire and Locke heading into the forest at Tuppency Links, and Claire flat out denied it. It was an egregious lie, but it wasn't the lie per se that bothered Siobhan. It was the lie covered up by a slew of other lies. What were all the meetings for? What happened at these meetings? Jason was perhaps too close to see the writing on the wall, but Siobhan could read it. Something was going on. Why wasn't Claire owning up to it? Claire was hiding something, and Siobhan was offended and hurt by this. She was angry at Claire and angry at herself. Siobhan was too sarcastic, maybe, or too tough. the result of learning to survive as one of eight children, and Claire was as soft as the center of a fancy chocolate. She was afraid to confide in Siobhan. Siobhan was dying to ask Claire, "How do you feel about Locke? Do you like working with him? You spend a lot of time together. Do you have feelings for him?" Claire's relationship with Locke seemed to be reaching beyond the normal, beyond the everyday. It seemed to have taken on an intimacy that overstepped the appropriate. But Siobhan was not brave enough to bring it up with Claire. And so, they were at an impasse. Claire would not confide in Siobhan about Locke. Siobhan would not confide in Claire about Carter's gambling or anything else. Their friendship was suffering. It had been a brutal winter. Siobhan took the $500 from Carter, stuffed it in her jeans pocket, and went into town. As she was leaving the house, Carter said, "Buy yourself something pretty." Like he was a gangster, and she his moll. What a joke. Saturday afternoon in the middle of March, Federal Street was deserted. The place was a ghost town. And yet there, parked on the street, was Claire's car. Siobhan saw it as she walked into Eye of the Needle. This was Claire's favorite store. Maybe they would bump into each other and go to the Brotherhood for a Bailey's. But Claire was not in the store. Siobhan stepped outside and called Claire's cell phone, and it went straight to voicemail. Instinctively, Siobhan knew that Claire was at the Nantucket's children's office on Union Street. She just knew it. Why not go and see for herself and end the questions once and for all? Siobhan felt like Nancy Drew, girl sleuth. She felt like Angela fucking Lansbury. Siobhan scooted down Federal Street, charged with an energy. It was hard to describe. She was going to catch her best friend at... what? Siobhan saw Claire tripping down the front steps of the church. Siobhan checked her watch. 4:30. Mass was at 5, but Claire was leaving the church, not going into it, and every good Catholic knew there were only 3 reasons to go to church in the middle of the afternoon: wedding, funeral, confession. Siobhan didn't see a bride and groom, nor did she see a hearse. Claire? Claire whipped around. Guilty. Caught. "Hey," she said weakly. Siobhan glanced pointedly at the church. "What are you doing?" Claire said, "What are you doing? God, town is dead." "Were you at confession?" Siobhan asked. Claire looked behind her at the church, as though surprised to find it there. "Yeah," she said. "I was. You know, I try to get JD and Ottilie to go, but they won't, so I figure lead by example or whatever. A little repenting never hurt anyone." Claire was the easiest person in the world to read. Now she had 2 hot spots on her cheeks. Siobhan, girl sleuth, had another clue. Although she had been raised in County Cork, and Claire had been raised in godforsaken coastal New Jersey, their Catholicism was the same. Siobhan hadn't been to confession since she was 12 years old, and she knew Claire hadn't either. It would have to be a pretty big sin to send her there. "I'm out shopping," Siobhan said. "Do you want to go somewhere and get a drink? Do you want to talk?" "No," Claire said, "I can't." "Just one drink, come on. I feel like I never see you anymore." "I have to get home," Claire said. "Jason, the kids, dinner, you know what my life is like." Siobhan nodded. They kissed, and Claire boogied for her car. Siobhan headed around the corner, ostensibly to check for something pretty at Erica Wilson, but she really just moved out of sight so she could catch her breath from the shock. Claire, at confession. You know what my life is like. But did she? There was a song the kids liked about having a bad day, and when it came on the radio, Claire was required to turn up the volume, and the 3 older children sang along while Zach cried. Claire hated the song. It taunted her. The spring, a season of rebirth and new hope, was turning out to be a disaster for her. She had one bad day after another after another. Take, for example, what was going on in the hot shop. For months, she had been trying to get started on the pulled taffy chandelier for the gala auction. But it was all false starts and wasted time. She blew out a beautiful globe, which was to be the center of the chandelier, the body. It was colored a transcendental pink, the most luscious pink Claire had ever achieved, because of the painstaking way she had crushed the frit with a mortar and pestle. The globe was perfect. It was platonic. It was as thin and wondrous as the bubbles. She was back on track, hitting her stride, but then the perfect platonic globe shattered in the annealer, and when Claire saw this, she cried for 3 days. She cried with Jason. She cried with Locke. Both of them pretended to get it, but they didn't get it, not really. And she was vexed because they both ultimately expressed the same sentiment. It's okay. You'll do another one, and the second one will be even better. They used the same tone of voice. They were, in those moments, the same man. Disturbing. Claire tried to explain that it wasn't just the globe that was broken. It was her confidence and her will. She did, however, try again, and the result was probably just as good, lacking only the luster of perfection that the first globe had acquired in Claire's mind. Toward this second globe, she acted like an overprotective mother. When it was cool, she set it gingerly in a crate filled with straw, and from time to time she revered it, like it was baby Jesus lying in his manger. With the body of the chandelier finished, she moved on to the arms. The arms of the chandelier had to arch and curve. They would have the same pulled taffy nature as the candlestick she had made so long ago for Mr. Fred Bulrush, all that twisty, colored glass, but they had to fall like tendrils from the globe. They had to drip. That meant Claire had to pull each arm by hand and get it to curve and bend just the right way, twisting it at the same time. It was impossible. It was beyond her, like certain positions in yoga. She couldn't make the glass do what she wanted it to do. She tried 60 times to get one graceful arabesquing arm, and when she finally had it, the one arm, she wept some more, because she could see how incredible the chandelier would be if she ever finished it. But she wasn't sure she had the patience to make 7 more arms. In fact, Claire pulled another arm beautifully within her next 10 tries, but because she was working by hand and not with a mold, this second arm did not correspond with the first. The angle of the curve was too sharp. If she attached these 2 arms to the globe now, one arm would look broken. More tears. Locke said, "There was no guaranteeing that it was going to come easily. In fact, one of the reasons this piece is so valuable is that it is so difficult. We're paying for your blood, sweat, and tears." Claire nearly swore at him. This was a piece for an auction. It was a donation, and it was consuming all of her time. It had been a mistake to return to the hot shop. She had lost her touch. The chandelier was beyond her, and yet it was the only thing she wanted to do. So there you had it. She had set herself an unattainable goal, and all it brought her was frustration and heartbreak. Jason was right. She should have let him bomb the hot shop, or shoot it full of arrows, burn it down, put Darth Vader into gear and run it over. Claire placed the globe for the chandelier and the one peerless arm in the crate and set them on top of her filing cabinet, out of the way. She would think about the chandelier later. The best thing to do when the glass wasn't cooperating, her instructors used to tell her, was to walk away. Take a break. Claire took Ottilie and Shay to get haircuts, and then, as a super-duper special treat, manicures. Claire got a manicure herself, but the mere sight of her hands reminded her of the chandelier, and she left the salon with 2 giggling girls and a heavy heart. The chandelier called out to her. It haunted her. It was a baby she'd abandoned in a dumpster, screaming for her. Talk about waking nightmares. Claire managed to make it through dinner, but after the kids were asleep, she went back into the hot shop and fashioned a tiny, bell-shaped cup onto the end of the one and only arm. This was where the bulb would go. It was sweet and precious, this tiny cup, like the blossom of a lily of the valley. Claire felt good about the project for about 5 minutes. Then she started in on another arm. 47 tries later, she was in tears again. She climbed into bed next to Jason, who woke up momentarily and said, "Jesus, Claire, just forget about it. You're making yourself crazy." 2 is a French at nyc.rr.com from cdc@nantucket.net. Sent March 27, 2008, 1:32 a.m. Subject, auction item. Isabel, I am having a very hard time producing an item for the auction. I plan to make a chandelier, which I thought would be a real winner, but it isn't turning out as I had hoped. I know it's late in the game as far as these things go, but I wondered if you might be able to scare up another auction item. Perhaps we should revisit the singing lessons or loge seats to South Pacific, followed by a meet and greet with Kristen Chenoweth. With everything I have on my plate right now, the idea of having to produce this piece of art is bone-crushing. It's keeping me up at night. As you can see, I am writing this email at 1 a.m. I am losing sleep. Will you please help me explore other options? Thanks, Claire. To cdc@nantucket.net. From isafrench@nyc.rr.com. Sent March 28, 2008. 7:32 a.m. Subject, auction item. Dear Claire, I have the fullest confidence that you will create a breathtaking piece for our auction. The sentiments of the committee during our initial meeting are ones that I share. You are an island artistic treasure, and having your masterpiece to auction is a coup for Nantucket's children indeed. Dinner with Kristen, although a fabulous idea, might have been an option for us back in October, but by now she has donated away all her time for the next calendar year. I really do think we will have to stay our course with your magnificent piece. Thanks, Isabel. To isafrench@nyc.rr.com from cdc@nantucket.net. Sent March 28, 2008, 9:12 a.m. Subject, auction item. What about the G5? To cdc@nantucket.net from isafrench@nyc.rr.com. Sent March 28, 2008, 9:13 a.m. Subject, auction item.
What about it?
To isafrench@nyc.rr.com from cdc@nantucket.net. Sent March 28, 2008, 9:35 a.m. Subject, auction item. The round-trip flight anywhere? The cocktail party on board? I thought that was the best idea of all. Is it still available? To cdc@nantucket.net from isafrench@nyc.rr.com. Sent March 28, 2008, 9:37 a.m. Subject, auction item.
No.
Claire should abandon it, declare it beyond her reach. They still had 4 months until the gala. They should certainly be able to come up with another option. Claire was positive that Isabel was insisting on the chandelier as a means of revenge. The damn thing would sap Claire's energy and steal her time, and then, to cap it all off, no one would bid on it except for Locke, and Claire would look like, indeed be, a failure. Abandon it. It was giving her one bad day after another. Her frustration with the chandelier was creeping into the rest of her life. She was late for pickup 2 days in a row, and she missed most of JD's first Little League game. Some part of Claire felt she deserved the torment the chandelier was causing her. She deserved it because she was a liar and a cheater. She was having an affair with Locke Dixon. She wondered if, after a certain amount of time passed, the intensity of her feelings for Locke would fade. Would the sparkle wear off? Would he seem familiar? Would she begin to notice the 20 pounds he had to lose, or the shiny bald spot on top of his head, or the words he routinely used to show off? Pernicious. Occult. No. Every day, every meeting, Locke Dixon seemed more amazing to Claire, more mysterious and unattainable, and therefore desirable than ever. She was in love with him, and it was making her miserable. When she couldn't be with him, which was nearly all the time, she was a hostage to her longing. She couldn't enjoy anyone else, not her kids, not Siobhan, not Jason. She counted hours, minutes. She rearranged her schedule. She skipped things, blew them off, so she could spend one more bittersweet hour with Locke. One night, Claire and Locke sat at the table in the conference room, holding hands. They were naming the things they would do if they were free in the world together.
Play cards.
Fly to Spain.
Where in Spain?
Ibiza.
Take you shopping. Watch you try on clothes.
Eat Big Macs.
Go to the movies.
Ride a Ferris wheel.
Climb the Eiffel Tower.
Climb Mount Everest. No, scratch that. Too hard.
Go fishing. In Ibiza.
Build a campfire, roast marshmallows.
See a concert.
Who?
Tough decision. Anyone, past or present? Frank Sinatra.
Love it. My turn. Share the Sunday paper. You can have the business section.
Stand in line together at the post office.
We could do that now, if you wanted to.
But I would have to be holding you from behind, with my chin resting on top of your head.
Oh.
Your turn. What else?
Sleep in the same bed. Just once. One night.
They were both quiet after she said that. It was a fun game, and funny, but demoralizing too. All the things they wanted to do together, but couldn't. The simplest things. Stand in line at the post office, share a pew at church, shop for a new watch, pick out a video. As they sat in silence, their hands squeezing, stroking, squeezing again.
Don't let me go.
Claire wondered how bad her life would be if she left Jason and married Locke. She wondered this all the time, and the answer was
bad.
Very bad. The kids would hate her. They would side with Jason. Their lives would become a mess that even therapy couldn't straighten out. Claire would lose all her friends, including Siobhan. She would lose her position in the community, and she was certain that Locke, once he was married to her, would become disenchanted. Still, she wondered. Because it was on nights like these, nights when, instead of frantically making love, they talked and floated around in their fantasies, that Claire didn't think she could stand it another day. She was in love with the man. She wanted to be with him. Claire was at Hatch's, the liquor store, on a Saturday afternoon of cold and driving rain. Jason had the kids at home, and Claire wanted out, just for a few minutes. The weekends were murder, a wasteland of no Locke, of Claire's trying at home, trying to cook something nice, trying to be engaged in family life.
Want to play Parcheesi, Mom?
Okay, sure, she could do that. It would be fun. They played five games with Zach whimpering and stuffing the colored pegs in his mouth. Jason sat right there alongside them, watching a bowling tournament on TV.
Is there any beer? He asked.
Claire checked the fridge. They were out of beer. Instead of telling Jason, "Sorry, honey, no," instead of yelling or taking the moral high ground because she had just spent 2 hours entertaining the kids while he moldered in their midst, she saw this as her opportunity. Before he could protest, she snapped up the car keys.
Liquor store, she said. Be right back.
She stood in front of the towers of white wine with a bottle of Viognier in her hands. Hatches was busy, a rabbit warren of activity. Wet people buying cigarettes, scratch tickets,
Snack food, the newspaper, beer, wine, champagne, vodka, gin, scotch, Cuervo Gold, whatever helped them through. The door had a lovely little bell that rang every time someone went in or out. Claire didn't want to leave the store. She didn't want to go back to her house. She was a woman in a movie, a character from a Bruce Springsteen song. She went out for a bottle of expensive French wine and never went back.
Claire? A voice said. Is that you?
Claire swiveled. A person in a green raincoat, holding a dripping Burberry umbrella. A woman, familiar. But there was a split second when Claire was stymied.
Who?
Then, the medicine ball to the stomach.
Daphne.
Hi, Claire said like a maniac. Daphne took the very same bottle of Viognier that Claire held in her hands off the shelf. Claire was suffused with heartache, and then fear, and then heartache again. Daphne was picking up Locke's wine, or their wine together, wine for an afternoon by the fire, wine for whatever dinner plans they had tonight. Out? In? Which would be better? Which would be worse? Claire shifted her own bottle of Viognier behind her back, but this movement must have seemed furtive, because it drew Daphne's attention.
You drink Viognier? She asked.
All the time, Claire wanted to say. It's my favorite varietal. But this was out of the question. Claire gazed at the wine bottle in her hands.
I just picked this up, she said. I don't really know what it is.
Daphne stared at Claire for a second. Was she suspicious? Would she know that Claire and Locke drank Viognier in the office all the time? Or was she simply stunned by Claire's ignorance?
How are you? Daphne said. How's everything going with the gala planning?
Trick question? You never knew with Daphne.
Fine, Claire said.
She sounded very nonchalant to her own ears, disinterested even. Things are falling into place bit by bit.
I'm glad for that, Daphne said. I finally convinced Locke to get away.
Claire nodded. What was Daphne talking about? Get away. From her? Or what? Claire was confused, but she kept right on nodding.
Whatever you say, Daphne, you bet. We're going to Tortola a week from Friday, Daphne said.
Tortola?
It's one of the British Virgin Islands.
Oh, right, Claire said. I know what it is, I just didn't realize.
She couldn't continue. We're going for a week.
With Heather? Claire said.
What must her face look like?
She was, as far as she could tell, still upright, though her legs were threatening to buckle. The wine was dangling from her hand like a club.
Is it her spring break?
We're going alone, Daphne said. Just the two of us. It's time. We need it. We'll go see Heather first for the weekend, then we'll fly out of Logan to the Caribbean. We're staying at this ultra-chic new place called...
It sounds fabulous, Claire said.
Then realized Daphne wasn't finished. But no matter.
Claire was finished.
Finished. When she got into her car, she would decide if she should cry or vomit, but she couldn't do either right now.
I'm surprised Locke didn't mention it to you, Daphne said. He is so anxious to get away. The vacation is all he talks about.
Well, with this weather, Claire said, who can blame him?
Exactly, Daphne said.
And what about you? Her nose wrinkled, and Claire wondered if she was about to make another nasty comment about Claire and the shower. Well, if she did, Claire would smack the nose right off her face.
Okay, this was bad. A bad thought, a bad series of thoughts, a bad, bad situation.
Facing her lover's wife in the liquor store, both of them buying the same bottle of wine, Locke's favorite fucking wine, and then the news of the vacation?
Unspeakably bad.
What about me? Claire asked.
Are you going away? Daphne asked.
She took a stab.
Disney?
No, Claire said, not this year.
That's too bad, Daphne said. I suppose it's hard with the kids.
Hard, Claire agreed. She widened her eyes, as if remembering something. I have to get Jason some beer, she said. That's what I came for.
Oh, Daphne said. She seemed disappointed at Claire's retreat.
Okay.
Well, enjoy the Viognier.
Thanks, Claire said, backing away. Enjoy Tortola.
Claire's emotions were so complicated, she didn't even know where to start. Locke was going to Tortola with Daphne, alone, for a week. It's time, we need it. And he hadn't even bothered to tell her himself. She had to hear it from Daphne. This was awful. This was the low point. Every minute of every hour since Claire had returned home from the liquor store, she had chastised herself. One of the rules of having an affair was that you weren't allowed to feel this kind of jealousy. Claire could not be jealous of Daphne. Daphne was Locke's wife. She had legal ownership, the history, the name, the home, the child. Of course he would go on vacation with Daphne. How could Claire protest? She could not. Agreeing to an affair meant agreeing to a relationship without claims. She had no rights to him. That she should feel utterly betrayed was backward. It was Daphne who should feel betrayed, but Daphne would spend a week with Locke alone at some ultra-chic new resort. They would be making love on a wide, soft bed, not on top of a conference table. It was horrible to contemplate Locke and Daphne together romantically, sexually. But what a hypocrite she was. She slept every night next to Jason. She made love to him. She even had orgasms. But it was not attended with the same heartbreaking desire that she felt for Locke. What she experienced with Jason was exercise. It was fondly going through the motions. It was empty. She and Locke had talked about this carefully. They had agreed. They would both be happier together, sharing the paper, eating Big Macs, fishing in Ibiza. The happiness brought about simply by talking about these things was impossible to conjure now. Tortola. Just the two of us. We need it. Claire's phone rang on Monday morning at 8:15. She was in the car, on her way home from dropping the kids off at school. She checked the display. Locke. She threw the phone as hard as she could at the passenger door. The phone broke into its component parts. Zach started to cry. Finished. In the driveway, Claire put her phone back together with trembling hands. It rang again. Locke. Again, she ignored it. She handed Zach off to Pan and went about the tasks of her day. Finished. The calls came every hour. Claire lasted until 4 o'clock. Pan watched the kids. Claire took her phone out to the hot shop. She didn't bother with hello.
Why didn't you tell me earlier?
I was afraid.
Afraid of what?
That you'd be angry.
Any idea how grossly humiliating it was to hear it from Daphne?
I was horrified. I would have called you Saturday if I could have.
You should have told me yourself back whenever it was that you made the plans. A month ago, 2 months?
I am so sorry, Claire. I am prostrate at your feet.
Are you?
Yes. God, yes, I love you.
You didn't tell me. Why? Because you didn't think I could handle it?
No, I knew you could handle it. But I didn't think you'd like it.
You're right, Claire said. I don't like it. It's not fair, but I don't like it.
I know, he said softly. I don't want you to like it.
So you're trying to make me jealous, then? Is that why you're going?
No, he said. I'm going because Daphne wants to get away someplace warm, and I can't blame her. And I have guilt, Claire. And one of the ways to assuage my guilt is to throw Daphne a bone, and Tortola is that bone.
Couldn't you have bought her something, a diamond ring?
She wanted to get away. Well, that was something Claire understood. The island was frigid, gray, rainy, and miserable, without a single sign of spring, except for a few hardy crocuses. Maybe Claire and Jason should go away. They could one-up Locke and Daphne and go to Venezuela or Belize. But Jason would never agree to it. He didn't even like to go to Hyannis.
Okay, Claire said. I understand.
Do you? Did she? No.
Yes, she said.
She understood, but that didn't mean she wasn't filled with jealousy, fury, and longing. Locke had promised he would stay in touch by email, but after checking her email 15 times in the first 4 hours of his absence, Claire gave up. She didn't have time to pine after someone like this. She didn't have time to go into her home office, log on to the computer, punch in her secret password, and wait while the computer told her there were no new messages in her inbox. She had to put her heart in a crate of straw, along with the newborn chandelier. She had to tuck it away in the storage closet until Locke came back. She should take advantage of this time apart and use it to spend time with her children. Zach was turning one. Her baby. Zach had made some progress. Instead of sitting like a potted plant before crying to be picked up, he scooted forward on his butt if he really wanted something. Claire threw a small party for his birthday. Siobhan and Carter and the boys came over, and Claire made spaghetti and homemade meatballs and a beautiful salad and golden crispy garlic bread. She went to great pains to make a cake that looked like a giraffe, because although Zach couldn't say the word giraffe, it was the one animal he was able to identify. When Claire asked, "Where's the giraffe, Zach?" he pointed right to it. It was his favorite animal. Claire made a template out of paper. She cut the cakes just so. She dyed the icing yellow and brown. She placed gumdrops for the eyes. "It's a gorgeous cake," Siobhan said. "Must have taken you forever." Claire said, "Yeah, it did, but I found myself with some extra time this week." Siobhan stared at her, and Claire busied herself with the salad dressing. The birthday dinner was a success, Claire decided, despite the fact that Zach cried when they sang, despite the fact that he was more interested in chewing the wrapping paper than in the presents inside. Claire drank 4 glasses of the blasted Viognier, and it made her teary. She had no idea if Locke remembered that it was Zach's birthday, though back in the fall he had asked Claire to write all the kids' birthdays down so he could memorize them. Claire had not predicted how emotionally fraught Zach's birthday would be, because contained within the celebration was the unspoken fact that they had almost lost him, that he'd been born so early, so unprepared for life outside the womb. Only 2 pounds, 7 ounces, he'd fit in Jason's palm. He wore a diaper the size of a cocktail napkin. No one mentioned her fall in the hot shop or the jet ride to Boston or the 5 weeks in the hospital. Was Claire the only one who remembered? She looked at Zach and thought, "I am so sorry, buddy." The party was lovely, the food delicious, the cake charming. Zach was fine, Claire told herself. He was whole and healthy and loved. As Claire was clearing the dishes, Siobhan, who had consumed no small amount of wine herself, wiped the lenses of her glasses on her dinner napkin and said, "Guess who I caught going to confession last week?" Claire's heart went into a free fall. She said nothing. Jason and Carter said, "Who?" And Siobhan said, "Claire." Claire set the dishes in the sink and turned on the water full blast and hot. Carter said, "Got something on your conscience, Claire?" Siobhan said, "Something big, I'd say." Steam rose from the sink. Jason said, "Hey, nah, leave her alone. You know Claire, always stopping her car so the guinea hens can cross, instead of running them off the road like the rest of us do. She's as pure as the driven snow." They all laughed at that, and the matter was forgotten. When, at the end of the night, Claire kissed Siobhan goodbye, Siobhan tasted bitter, like antiseptic. And even later, when Jason came to bed, he stroked Claire's hip and said, "I understand about the confession. We're lucky to have him, you know. We're lucky the little guy's alive." The next morning, Claire took Zach to Dr. Patel's office for his 12-month shots. Claire had checked her email. Nothing. And she checked her cell phone every 20 minutes for a text message.
Surely Locke could send a text message. Zack was gaining weight. He was getting taller, and his eyes looked good, as did his ears, nose, and throat. His lungs were clear, his reflexes automatic. He screamed during the shots, yowled so that Claire tensed every muscle in her body, but then she held him and gave him his pacifier, and he calmed down. Geeta Patel smiled at Claire and said, "He looks great. Do you have any concerns?" "I look at him," Claire said, "and I feel something isn't right."
"Something like what?" Dr. Patel said.
"Like, he's not developing fast enough. He can't walk. He doesn't crawl on his hands and knees. He cries all the time. He doesn't have any words. He isn't active or engaged like my other kids were."
Dr. Patel put a finger out. Zack grabbed it. She held his hands, and he took a few steps down the examining table. She tickled his feet, and he smiled, then started crying.
"See?" Claire said.
"He's fine, Claire," Dr. Patel said.
"He was so little when he was born," Claire said. "He was intubated for so long, I shouldn't have been in the hot shop. It was irresponsible."
She picked Zack up and hugged him.
"I feel so guilty."
"He's fine, Claire. He's going to be fine. Kids develop at different rates, even siblings.
Okay?
If I had any doubts, I would tell you, but I don't."
"You're sure?"
"I'm sure."
Dr. Patel put her hand on Claire's arm, and this gesture and the words were so comforting that Claire nearly said, "I have a lover, Locke Dixon, and he's in Tortola with his wife. I miss him. I need him. Father Dominic says I have to stop, but it's beyond me. Sometimes I can't believe this is really me because I am not like this. I'm a good person, or I always had been until this thing. Can you help me?"
"Thank you,"
Claire said.
Bad day followed bad day. Locke was away, still away. How was he filling all those hours with Daphne? Claire thought of Daphne, breasts spilling out of her bathing suit, swimming in a pool with an infinity edge while some cute British butler brought her a planter's punch. Claire considered emailing Locke and telling him about the visit with Dr. Patel. He would be interested in this. He would be happy to hear Claire repeat Dr. Patel's words. But no, she would not contact him first. He had yet to send her a single email. So, if he was wondering how things were going, let him wonder. Siobhan called to say that Carter had had an unexpected windfall, and to celebrate they were throwing a drinks party. Martinis and munchies, Saturday night. This raised Claire's spirits. Locke was with Daphne in Tortola, but Claire had a wild, rollicking party to attend. She would get perniciously drunk. Claire was all keyed up for Saturday night. Carter and Siobhan threw the best parties on the island, and all of Claire's friends would be there, the people in her foxhole. She looked in her closet for something to wear. She yearned for something new, although she never had time to shop. She put on jeans and a jade green cashmere sweater and pearls. She tried not to think about Locke. As she got ready, she drank a glass of wine, and Jason drank a beer, and they listened to Max West on the stereo in their room. Jason was wearing jeans and a black shirt and a black blazer and his cowboy boots. His hair was damp and mussed, and Claire ran her hands through it, smoothing it. He smelled good. His face had a day or two of growth, which was how she liked it, scruffy, and he had a tan from working outside. It had been weeks since he'd come home reeking of cigarette smoke, she realized. She should be grateful for that. Jason was handsome. He was sexy. And she could see this and know it intellectually. But it was hard to make herself feel anything.
"Do you want to fool around?" she asked, thinking it must be a balmy night in Tortola, and Locke and Daphne would be on their way out to dinner, ordering grilled lobster and conch fritters. Jason glanced at his watch.
"We don't really have time, do we?"
Claire blinked at him, stunned. In 15 years, he had not turned away from even the slightest chance of getting lucky. They had been late for all sorts of things because of Jason's libido. They were famous for being late. She shrugged.
I guess not.
She touched his collar.
You look good tonight, Jace.
You too, he said. Claire poured a second glass of wine into one of Zach's plastic cups and drank it on the way to Siobhan's house. They took Jason's truck. It was warm enough to crack the windows, and Jason hummed along to the Allman Brothers on the radio. Claire looked at his profile, as familiar to her as her own face. He was her husband. They had built a family together, a house together, a life together. And yet, they had nothing in common anymore, did they? Except their mutual efforts to sustain what they had created. They were alone, out of the house together for the first time all week, and they had nothing to say. Claire could ask him about the job, but he didn't want to talk about work. She could revisit for the 100th time the encouraging things that Dr. Patel had said about Zach, but the words lost their effect every time she repeated them. She wanted to ask Jason why he had turned her down back in the bedroom. Was he angry with her? Had he noticed her foul mood of the past 10 days and connected it to Locke's absence? Did he know what was going on? Had he lost interest in her finally this week? Had his desire for her dried up? Was he consumed with stress about the house in Walwinet or about something else? She was flabbergasted to find that she had no idea what he was thinking about. Does your back still hurt? She asked.
A little, he said.
Did you take a painkiller?
3 Advil, right when I got home.
He was driving very fast, as though anxious to get to the party, to see his brother and smoke dope in the basement. Claire wanted to get there too, but she couldn't stand to fritter away this time alone. If they didn't find each other right now, their marriage would end. This was an exaggeration. It was a manifestation of Claire's own guilt and stress, and the 2 glasses of wine taking hold of her senses, and the lingering sting of being turned down. But she felt it, deeply. Did they have any common ground? What had they talked about when they first met, when they were dating, when they were married but had not yet had children? They had been so focused on getting set up, getting situated and organized for the rest of their lives, that they had overlooked the fact that their relationship was based on nothing. Well, there was physical attraction, a mutual love for the island, a desire to raise a family, but was that it? Shouldn't there be a shared passion for something else, even if it was just for watching Junkyard Wars? Claire hated it. She wanted to travel with the kids, take them to Machu Picchu and to Egypt to see the pyramids, but would that ever happen? She wanted to read novels and see films and talk about important ideas. Claire was reading a book of short stories by an Aboriginal writer that Locke had recommended, but whenever she started explaining the book to Jason, he glazed over. She looked around the dark truck. It was a mess. Coffee-stained napkins, sections of old newspaper, CD cases from his prized Grateful Dead bootlegs, fishing lures, breath mints, keys to God knows what, a rubber duck with the beak chewed off, which had been around since Shay was a baby, the Angler's Club hat that had belonged to Jason's father, Malcolm. She picked up the hat. "Do you miss your dad?" she asked. Jason closed his eyes for a split second. "You know, I was just thinking about him today."
"Were you?"
"Yeah. It's so strange you asked me. I was thinking about my 10th birthday and how he took me to play my first round of golf at Sankaty. He had a winter membership that year and it was too cold to walk it, so he spent $30 on a cart, and he brought along a thermos of coffee with Bailey's or something in it that he let me sip from."
Jason swallowed. "It was special, you know, because he was showing me that I was growing up." He shook his head. "It's like sex. How many rounds of golf have I played? But I'll always remember that first time."
"I miss your dad, too," Claire said.
"He was a great guy," Jason said. "The greatest."
You know, I want to do something like that for JD's birthday. Maybe I will. See if I can take him for 9 holes at Sankaty.
Minus the Baileys, Claire said.
Right, Jason said.
Claire relaxed in her seat. She thought of Malcolm Crispin, Jason and Carter's father, a great old salty guy who worked for the water company for 40 years, who loved golfing and fishing and grilling big fat steaks and drinking red wine and smoking cigars on the deck of the Anglers Club. Malcolm died of mouth cancer when JD was a baby, but he'd given Claire a strand of pearls, the ones she was now wearing, for delivering the first Crispin grandchild. Siobhan had been pregnant with Liam when Malcolm died, and she'd never gotten over the fact that Malcolm hadn't lived to see Carter's children, or that Claire had gotten the pearls. But even Siobhan's resentment was born of the fact that they were all one clan, the Crispins. Those ties counted for something. Jason pulled up in front of Carter and Siobhan's house. There were cars lined up all the way down the street. Claire drank down the rest of her wine. Jason opened his door and climbed out. Claire said, "Jason?" He peered in at her.
"Thank you for telling me that story," she said. "About the golf with your dad, it was nice."
He shook his head. "It's weird," he said. "It's like you read my mind." At that moment, Tortola seemed very far away. Claire felt better. They went inside. The party was lovely. The living room was clean and cozy and lit only by votive candles. People carried drinks in frosted glasses and jewel-like canapes. There was conversation, laughter, the sexy strains of Barry White floating down from the in-ceiling speakers. Siobhan was across the room wearing something new, something slinky and pink that left one of her shoulders bare. She was surrounded by people. Claire tried to catch her eye, but when she did, Siobhan gave her a half wave that felt like a brush off. Claire's good mood was like a basket of fruit balancing on her head. It teetered precariously. Claire poured herself a glass of wine, and then another glass. She talked to people she had seen only in passing since Christmas. Julie Jackson, Amy Trimble, Delaney Kitt, Phoebe Caldwell, Heidi Fisk.
"Where have you been hiding yourself?"
"No, not hiding," Claire said emphatically. "Just so busy, beyond busy, now that I'm back at work."
"How's the baby? He must be getting so big."
"So big," she echoed.
"He's doing great. Just had his first birthday. He's nearly started crawling. He's fine." She drank. She chatted. She did not eat nearly enough, though the food was to die for. Guacamole with fresh corn, mini Asian crab cakes that were sweet with coconut milk, scallops wrapped in bacon with horseradish sauce.
"Yum," Claire said to Siobhan, as Siobhan passed by with succulent Chinese ribs.
Siobhan gave Claire a pointed look over the top of her square glasses. Claire's good mood tumbled. Was Siobhan mad? Claire thought back. They hadn't talked in 2 days. Claire had left a message, or maybe two, which Siobhan hadn't answered. This was unusual, but Siobhan was busy. She was throwing a party. Claire threaded her way through the crowd until she spotted Siobhan offering a rib to Adams Fisk. Claire tapped Siobhan on the shoulder.
"Hey."
"Hey," Siobhan said flatly.
"What's wrong? Are you mad at me?"
Siobhan nodded toward the hallway, where it was dim and quiet. Claire followed, her heart scuttling.
"What is it?" Claire said.
"I spoke to Edward."
"And?"
"You don't know?"
"Know what?"
"He gave the catering job to someone else, for the gala."
"He did what?"
"He gave it to A la Table."
"Genevieve?"
"Genevieve."
"I can't believe it."
"It gets better."
"What?"
"Because Edward wasn't even the one who told me. I found out from Genevieve herself. I saw her at the farm market. And you know her, she couldn't keep herself from spilling it. She was so happy, she just had to tell me. She got the catering job for the Nantucket's Children's Summer Gala."
"Oh, shit. So
I went home, and I called Edward, and he confirmed it. He took their bid. They came under by nearly $40 a head.
Oh, shit.
You didn't know this?
I had no idea.
Because I asked him if you knew, and he said he sent you an email.
Oh, Claire said. Well, he might have. I haven't checked my email in a couple of days.
Siobhan took a step closer to Claire, so that the edge of the platter of ribs nudged Claire in the stomach. Siobhan's glasses slipped down her nose, and her face flushed pink.
Edward knows nothing about food, and even less about wine. You could serve him peanut butter on a cedar shingle, and he'd say it was delicious, or a glass of vintage lighter fluid. Why did you put him in charge of catering?
He volunteered, and I thought he'd pick you, I was sure of it.
But he didn't pick me, did he?
Oh, Siobhan, I'm sorry.
Sorry? You're sorry? That's all you're going to say?
What else do you want me to say? Tell me and I'll say it.
You were wrong to put Edward in charge of catering. It was a gross error in judgment on your part. You were sure he'd pick me. But if you had any common fucking sense, or better still, if you had just asked me, I would have pointed out that Edward has just been waiting all these years for a chance to screw me over, for an opportunity to humiliate me the way he feels I humiliated him by breaking the engagement and marrying Carter. Otherwise, why would he have picked Genevieve? She sucks. Her food tastes like shit. She actually makes an appetizer using Fruit Loops, and she hasn't timed an event correctly since she got into the business. He picked her because he knows she's my rival. He knows I detest her. It would have been better if he had chosen some fancy-pants New York caterer. But Genevieve? The reason she came $40 a head under is that she hires her 16-year-old daughter and her daughter's friends to serve.
I am so sorry, Claire said. I was wrong to put Edward in charge.
Don't just feed my words back to me, Claire. I find that very patronizing.
At the time, at the meeting, he was singing your praises, telling everyone how great you were, and I thought it was a sure thing.
Claire reached out and touched Siobhan's arm, but Siobhan pulled away suddenly and nearly dropped the platter of ribs. Claire was pretty drunk. She didn't seem to be handling this situation the right way, but Siobhan might have been drunker.
You know what the worst part is?
Siobhan said. Her voice wavered, and her eyes filled with tears.
You're different. Since you took this stupid job as co-chair, Claire Crispin, you're a different person.
I'm not different, Claire said.
You lied to me about being at Tuppency back at Christmas time. Siobhan said. Her voice was now a furious whisper. I saw you. You nearly fucking ran me over, and then you denied ever being there.
Claire scoffed, though inside her, discomfort bloomed. She had been at Tuppency with Locke. They had been seeking a private spot, and it had been startling to come across Siobhan. So startling that Claire drove on, convinced that she was mistaken.
What should I do? She asked Locke.
And he said, deny it.
I can't believe you're taking me to task for something that happened back before Christmas, Claire said.
Admit you were at Tuppency, Siobhan said. Admit that Locke was in your car.
Locke, Claire said.
Then, a few weeks ago, I see you at confession.
Siobhan leaned forward.
Fucking confession, Claire. What was that about?
I told you I...
Do you take me for an idiot, Claire?
There it was, Claire thought. Siobhan suspected something was going on, but she had been left in the dark. Claire hesitated, thinking, I should have told her before. I should have picked a quiet time and place and told her. How much less excruciating would the past few months have been if she'd had a repository for her thoughts, her feelings, the delicious and the evil, the confident and the insecure. Claire should have told Siobhan about Locke before, but Claire couldn't tell her now, because Siobhan would be furious, perhaps fatally so, that Claire hadn't confided in her from the beginning.
What?
She would say, her Irish ire up.
What?
You didn't trust me.
And the truth would be out there between them, stinking and obvious. Claire didn't trust her. She couldn't tell Siobhan now, in the middle of the party. Maybe someday soon. But no, never. Claire would never tell, not even with Siobhan pushing her up against the wall. As long as it was just Claire and Locke, contained in a cell, it was not real. After they left each other, it vanished. It never was. It could not be pointed to or proved. There was no paper trail, not one physical, tangible object that implicated the two of them. If a tree falls in the forest, and no one is there to hear it, does it make a noise? No, Claire decided. As long as nobody knew, it was safe. If it stayed secret, nobody would get hurt. But somehow, Siobhan had gotten hurt. She knew that Claire had a new heart. You are a different person. Ironic that Siobhan had noticed, but not Jason. And yet Siobhan was closer to Claire in nearly every way, and Claire felt just as bad, if not worse, about betraying Siobhan. How to keep herself from spilling this, like the ribs all over the place. I've been upset about Zach, Claire said, which was true. His birthday brought it all back, and then on the way here, Jason and I were talking about Malcolm. Siobhan snorted. Malcolm, she said. Ah, yes. She turned away with her tray of ribs. By the way, nice pearls. Claire was about to follow her and say what to make things right, she couldn't guess, when she saw something that rendered her temporarily speechless. Her husband and Julie Jackson coming down the stairs. The stairs were lit with small votive candles on each end, but as far as Claire knew, that was just decoration and not an invitation to ascend the stairs. As far as Claire knew, the upstairs was dark and deserted except for Liam and Aiden, who were sleeping. Claire felt like she was going to vomit. Julie Jackson was the most beautiful woman Claire knew. She was touching Jason's arm, leaning into him, holding on to him. She was wearing a short skirt and a pair of very high heels, and she was having a hard time getting down the stairs. Claire thought back to Jason's turning her down in the bedroom. We don't really have time, do we? She thought of him racing over here in an unprecedented hurry. What on earth would Jason and Julie Jackson have been doing together, alone, in the dark upstairs? Claire might have looked to Siobhan for a reality check, but Siobhan had stormed off. Claire drank what was left of her wine and approached Jason. She knew her cheeks were pinking. She felt like her face was going to explode. Her eyeballs felt like hot glass, and her lips were stretched into a fake smile that made her teeth chatter. Julie squeezed Jason's arm and ducked out toward the kitchen. Jason said, "Hey, babe." "What were you doing upstairs?" Claire asked. Jason laughed and took a swig of his beer. "You should see your face." "I asked you a question." She could not